Hello and welcome to the Money Talk podcast. I'm Ed Monk. Today on the show, we attempt to separate the emerging market myths from reality. Will they ever really emerge into developed markets? Are they really faster growing in the long run? Tom Stevenson joins me for that. And then our interview with Paul Niven, manager of the F&C Investment Trust. We spoke about the trust's very long history and where Paul sees markets heading now when different assets seem to be telling us different things. If you enjoy the show, please rate us, share us, or leave a comment wherever you get your podcasts. There's always been a persuasive case for investing in emerging markets, but that case seems stronger now than ever before, with growth in the developed world stalling and predicted to be permanently stifled in the decades ahead. It's only natural to look to those parts of the world which still appear to have years of growth ahead of them. But for investors, is this point of view all too simplistic? Do these exciting emerging markets really deliver in the long run, as the theory suggests they will? To answer that, I'm joined by Fidelity Investment Director Tom Stevenson. Tom, welcome along. Let's talk about that case for emerging markets that I mentioned there. Why are they potentially so attractive and so attractive now?
Well, I think emerging markets are always attractive because fundamentally they are the fastest growing parts of the world. I mean, if you look at the growth rates in China and India, they've always been roughly sort of twice that in the developed world. But as we've had a slowdown in the developed world recently, those big emerging markets are probably growing at four times the pace of markets like the UK and the US and Germany in the developed world. So that's the sort of general case for investing in them.
And there's always, as well as the economic forecasts, which are really persuasive, there's always interesting little factoids. I was reading that if you look at the number of STEM graduates from India and China, it's something like seven times the number that you'll have from Japan and the United States, not backward-looking markets themselves. It's demographics like that that suggests it's a slam dunk.
Yes, it is demographics. They've got very fast-growing middle classes. They've got people who are sort of pulling themselves into a level of economic well-being where they've suddenly, for the first times in their lives in some cases, have got disposable income to buy consumer goods that they just didn't have a generation ago. And as you say, the educational point is a good one. You know, in many cases, these are really highly educated populations which can drive the economic growth in a modern world where that high level of education is a huge advantage.
And I guess attractive now because growth, as I say, let's look past the sort of noise of the short term. But we always talk about a lower for longer environment in the developed world. The IMF came out this week and had its forecast, and it suggests that over the next 3 years, you're going to have growth in the developed world shrinking gradually, almost to a level that the IMF in the past has described as recessionary. So that will be going one way, and then going the other way is the emerging markets, which will recover and just take up a bigger slice of the sort of global economic pie.
Yes, that's right. And if you look at emerging markets, they already represent, you know, the majority of growth in global output, and they also represent the majority of the world's population. So you know, something like 59% of the world's population lives in what are generally understood to be emerging markets from a stock market perspective. That compares with just 13% in developed countries.
Now, writing this week, Tom, you were looking back at some historic returns from emerging markets. Not an easy task to do, actually. How did you do it and what did you find?
Yes, well, I was helped in this endeavour by my old friends Dimpson, Marsh and Staunton. They're three professors at the London Business School, and they have been in the business of analysing stock market returns for many years. I mean, they've been doing this for as long as I've been a financial journalist, which is quite a long time. And their great achievement is that they have created this database of stock market performance data that goes all the way back to 1900. Now, they've generally done that with stock markets in the developed world. What they've done most recently in an annual publication that they produce for Credit Suisse, it's called the Credit Suisse Global Investment Returns Yearbook. Their focus this year was on emerging markets. And what they've done is they've created this database going back to 1900 for emerging markets. And as you say, that's actually quite an achievement, because you know, for some of these countries, there were many years when they simply didn't have stock markets. So I'm thinking about China, which, of course, closed its stock markets after the communist victory in 1949. Russia, of course, didn't have a stock market for many years. And, you know, you also have to think that there have been big changes in the composition of emerging and developed markets over that century and a quarter. So there are many countries which were emerging markets in 1900, which clearly are not now. I mean, you might even put, you know, the US in that category. Yeah. So a lot of real shifting sands, and they've managed to, you know, look through all those changes and create, you know, I think what is a reasonable stab at an index for emerging markets.
And of course, the perception of emerging markets is that they'll be more volatile, and there's reasons that we can talk about, but the payoff for that is a potentially higher growth, higher return environment. Is that actually true based on what you saw?
Yes and no is the answer. Everything about this is quite complicated. Is why it's so fascinating. If you look at the long run performance, then actually emerging markets have slightly underperformed their counterparts in developed markets. But if you look a bit closer, you'll see that the real reason for that was a big fall off in performance in the late 1940s after the Second World War, when, of course, Japan, which was then an emerging market, lost 98% of its value after the end of the war. And the Chinese market was, of course, wiped out completely because the Chinese just closed down the stock markets. If you start the analysis in 1950, then you'll see that actually emerging markets have outperformed developed markets over the last 70 years, although not by a huge amount.
Yeah, I looked at the numbers. It was an annualized returns of 10.5% for developed markets. That sounds good in the current environment. And for emerging markets, it was 11.7. So absolutely a significant increase in returns, but not sort of crazy.
No, actually, not as much as I would have expected. I mean, you know, compounded year after year after year, 1.2% a year actually makes a big difference. But, you know, you clearly are facing, you know, significantly more short-term volatility by investing in emerging markets. And most emerging markets have higher volatility than developed markets.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting that you mentioned a couple of points there about Japan and the war and China and its turn to communism and away from markets in general in the last century. That speaks to me, at least, of the types of risks you get in these markets. And I was also writing about emerging markets this week and was looking back to a bit more recently to 2001 and the coining of the BRIC moniker, the BRIC moniker for Brazil, Russia, India and China. These were supposed to be the countries identified by Goldman Sachs chairman Jim O'Neill as being the real economic leaders for the next century, really. And that's now not exactly sort of sniffed or laughed at, that moniker, but clearly things haven't worked out in the time since quite how those predictions suggested. India, China have grown a lot. Some of that has been captured in the stock market returns, but you look at Russia, you look at Brazil, commodity-dependent economies that have suffered. The lesson perhaps is that trying to identify a single country to outperform for not just a year or two, but for decades and decades, that's really hard.
Yes, and I think the BRIC moniker is an interesting one because it was always attempting to yoke together four very different economies. You talked about commodities. Russia and Brazil are really exporters of commodities, and China and India are importers of commodities, and even China and India are very different types of economies. So to put them together into one grouping was always a bit problematical. But the underlying point, you're absolutely right, that it's very difficult, and I would say, you know, inadvisable to try and pick the best emerging markets. The fact is that as a whole, it's a fast growing part of the economy. They're all very different. We've talked a lot about diversification and its benefits in the past. Actually, looking at investing emerging markets as a whole and spreading your assets across them makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a very interesting conversation a few years ago with an economist about the BRICS. He said that really the only commonality between them was that they were large, they had big populations. You could build a narrative for each one sort of becoming more open, if you like. But that was about it. And there was loads of other countries that you could include really in that group, Indonesia, maybe even Nigeria in Africa. But it was a bit arbitrary, that distinction between the BRICS and other emerging markets.
Hmm. And just one final point that I would make on investing in emerging markets is that, you know, in most cases, they're a long way away. You know, we don't know a huge amount, you know, from the perspective of an investor in Britain, you don't really know much about the ins and outs of Chinese or Indian or Brazilian companies. And I think it does make complete sense to put your money in the hands of investors who've got boots on the ground, who are actually there understanding the local economy, understanding the cultural differences, and understanding, you know, the companies themselves. So I, you know, diversification across economies, yes, and rely on the experts, I would suggest.
Yeah, and of course we should remember that whilst maybe you might be thinking that for ordinary investors they should increase their allocation to emerging markets, they don't actually have to do it by investing in companies in those emerging markets. You can invest through very large companies in developed markets like Europe and the UK in particular. They face all these markets.
Yes, and that's particularly true of European companies and Japan, actually. You know, both of them are big export nations, and a lot of those exports are going to the emerging world. So, you know, to take the example that I mentioned in the piece that I wrote at the beginning of the week, you know, BMW is a huge exporter of cars to China. They know a great deal more about the Chinese car market than I do as an investor. So, you know, that's actually quite a nice way of investing in this spectacular growth of the Chinese car market.
Okay, well, Tom, it is a fascinating subject. That's all we have time for now. Thanks.
Thanks.
Launched in 1868, the F&C Investment Trust, formerly Foreign and Colonial, was one of the earliest ways ordinary people could benefit from investing. Its manager is Paul Niven, and he recently sat down with me for an interview, which you're about to hear. Paul will go on to explain his thinking on markets today, but he started by telling me how the Trust's aims have developed from 1868 onwards until the 2019 version we see today.
So F&C Investment Trust was launched in 1868, so it's more than 150 years old. The original aim of the Trust was to provide investors of moderate means access to the same opportunities as large capitalists of the day. So essentially the proposition was one of democratising investment, enabling the masses, as it were, to have the same opportunities as large capitalists. It started out as an emerging market bond fund, investing in foreign and colonial government bond issues, then investing into credit, into equities in the 1920s, into private equity subsequently. And by the 1960s, it was largely invested in equities. And really since that time, for the last 50 years or so, it's been very much an equity product, listed and unlisted equity exposure.
And so characterise the F&C Investment Trust in 2019. How does it invest, and where does it invest?
So it's a global trust. We invest across a whole range of different markets. We've got around half of our exposure in the US, around 5 or 6% in the UK. Most of our investments are into listed equities, largely into large cap opportunities, or we do have a small cap allocation as well. And we do have a portion of the portfolio invested into private market opportunities, private equity, unlisted investments, an area that we have had experience for many decades now.
And of course, it's an investment trust, which means it has a particular structure, and you as the manager have particular tools that you can use as part of that. How do you go about using and applying those extra flexibilities within the management of the trust?
So there are several advantages that an investment trust has over open-ended equivalent funds. Firstly, we can go out and borrow money to invest, and that needn't be on a short-term basis. We can actually undertake very long-term borrowing. And in fact, we recently undertook an issue, or agreed to borrow money for 40 years at just over 2.7%. So essentially, being able to borrow across a range of different maturities enables us to lever the portfolio. If we can make excess returns across above the cost of borrowings, that will be beneficial for shareholder returns. So gearing is one aspect, one benefit that we have as an investment trust. Another benefit is that of putting aside our revenue in the good years to provision when times are perhaps less good, when we have lean years. And that enables us to smooth dividends through time. And in fact, we're 150 years old. We've paid a dividend in each of those last 150 years. We will shortly be paying our 151st dividend, and that will be the 48th consecutive annual rise in our dividend. And this ability to provision during the good times enables us to smooth that dividend profile, to grow dividends through time for shareholders. So we've got more than £100 million in revenue reserves that we've held back to enable us to fulfil the expectations that shareholders have of us to continue to raise dividends in the future.
I was going to say, it's a great attraction to the trust for investors, isn't it? Nothing's guaranteed in investment, but that history and that track record of a gently rising dividend is very reassuring.
They will, I think. We have a very long track record of not only paying dividends, but growing dividends through time. And the proposition of the trust really is to grow both capital and income through time for shareholders. So both are important. In that context, we look to deliver a good total return, but to ensure that we've got a gently rising dividend for shareholders.
Okay, now one aspect of the trust that I wanted to discuss, you've mentioned it already, and it's this proportion that you hold in unlisted companies. Can you briefly explain what that means, but also what it does to the performance in the trust?
Sure, so this was really the third advantage that closed-ended funds have over open-ended equivalents: the ability to take a long-term view in investment. And the reason that that's the case is because we don't have to contend with inflows and outflows on a daily basis from the trust, and therefore we can take a long-term perspective and also lock up capital for long-term opportunities. So essentially buy illiquid investments. In the case of F&C Investment Trusts, we buy private equity exposure. We do that through direct investment into funds, primary funds, secondary funds, as well as co-investments. What does it mean for performance? Well, over the longer term, we have enjoyed a good premium in terms of return on those unlisted opportunities in private equity over listed market equivalents. So there's a good excess return that we've achieved from investing in private markets. And one would expect that, because you are locking up capital for many years at a time, typically. But more recently, in 2018, clearly a very difficult period for not just equities, but asset markets more broadly. In that year, last year, we made over 20% from our private market portfolio, which is about 8% of the trust. So it had a meaningful contribution to return in what was a difficult environment for listed markets.
And I guess some of the most exciting opportunities may well be unlisted, because these are the companies where still got a lot of growing to do. They're not at the level of listing on public markets. It's an exciting place to invest.
Absolutely. We find some great opportunities in unlisted markets. We were early investors into Facebook in 2005. So there's still great opportunities. Still some great opportunities today. High growth companies that are yet to make an appearance on listed markets.
Okay. Another aspect I wanted to touch upon is an area that's getting more and more attention these days, and that's ESG investing, environmental, social, governance principles within investments. Now, the trust has been active in this area as an investor. It gets involved in the management of companies and it votes where it can wield its influence, doesn't it?
It does. So we believe that sustainability and governance issues are very important for investors. It's obviously an area of increasing focus and attention for shareholders and investors more broadly. We think that good governance, focus on good management, good corporate practice, does create value for shareholders through time. And for that reason, ESG is embedded in a number of our underlying investment processes that we run on underlying portfolios on the trust. What does that practically mean? Well, we consider it in terms of the investment proposition that a company will bring, but we also engage with companies that we invest in. So last year, we engaged with more than 150 companies across 25 countries. We're engaging in issues like corporate governance, labour standards, drug pricing, all issues which are relevant, I think, in terms of creation of long-term shareholder value. And we think it's better to engage with companies rather than necessarily exclude those companies. And we do vote. We do vote our shares. We've got a team in London that we use to take a very close look at the practices of management and vote accordingly.
And including issues like high pay and the alignment of interest between shareholders and management.
Exactly, inevitably pay and remuneration, diversity with board, these are big issues for all shareholders and we take them very seriously.
Indeed. Okay, finally then, Paul, let's talk about the world as it is today in April 2019. I read commentary that you wrote at the end of 2018 when the news wasn't particularly good. I suspect things look a little better now that we are in April. What's your sense of market direction now? And what are the risks at the moment that you're looking out for?
So we put where we are in context. 2018 was a very, very difficult year, not just in equities, as I said, but across a whole range of different asset categories. Towards the end of 2018, there were concerns on growth, economic growth, earnings growth, policy in terms of the central banks, US Federal Reserve in particular, slowdown in China, as well as trade tensions, which have been ongoing for some time. Moving forward a few months, a number of those concerns have not necessarily been alleviated, but certainly have diminished somewhat, or certainly the market seems to be pricing in something of a trough in terms of growth. We don't expect a great earnings season in the early part of this year, but looking slightly further ahead, we think that earnings are actually going to continue to grow, which is supportive for markets. There are some good news from China in the sense that some stimulative action has been taken there, that we maybe shouldn't be too worried about a hard landing in the Chinese economy. Trade seems to be heading in the right direction. It remains to be seen how it all pans out. But there are some positive signs, I think. But in broader context, the bull market is a decade old, more than a decade old now. The economic cycle is relatively extended in terms of length. But bull markets tend not to die of old age. They tend to be killed by policymakers. And that means that as long as policy remains reasonably easy, as long as fundamentals in terms of underlying corporate earnings growth remain supportive, that the equity market can continue to make progress. And that's my expectation. There are numerous risks. There are always lots of risks. And most recently, we did have some warning signals from the bond market where it briefly inverted, depending upon where you look in the curve. Now, that's a pretty good lead indicator of a future downturn, but there's a long and variable lag in terms of the downturn. And it's very dangerous to say that this time is different, but policy is still very, very accommodative and not necessarily consistent with a sustained downturn in the economy. But ultimately, I think if one is looking at equities overall, your stance will really be driven by your view on whether it is the end of the cycle, and we don't think we're there yet. So we think there is some more to go for, but we're late in the game, and it's important from our perspective to be diversified. And for that reason, we hold a range of diversified strategies on the trust geographically across different styles and sectors. And we think that makes us well placed to withstand any short-term volatility in markets.
Yeah, and I guess one of the changes since the end of last year, you talk about policy there, it had become more supportive because the Fed, it looked like maybe they weren't paying attention to signs of weakness in the economy. It looks like they are now.
It does, but you have to question whether the markets have perhaps gone a little bit too far in terms of expectations on the Fed. As we talked today, the market is anticipating a rate cut from the Fed later this year, which from my perspective maybe looks a little bit optimistic. So maybe markets are a bit ahead of themselves in terms of policymakers' willingness to actually become more accommodative, but certainly concerns about over-tightening, I think, certainly have diminished.
And as you mentioned, sort of the bond market, some worrying signs with inverted yield curve. The bond market does seem a bit more concerned than the equity market does at the moment.
It does, and there's different aspects to that. I mean, part of this is growth, but it's also inflation, and there's gently rising wage inflation in the US, but inflation doesn't seem to be much of a problem anywhere, and for that reason, markets really have priced out rate rises, and that's very supportive for bond markets. But yes, perhaps there is a bit of a disconnect in terms of the growth outlook priced into the bond market, and that priced into the equity market for choice. we think that the equity market is right and actually bond yields look too low at current levels, which is one reason why we took out that long-term debt.
Yeah. And are you a fully invested fund manager as we speak today?
So we are fully invested. In fact, we have around 6 or 7% gearing on the trust as it stands today.
So you're on the, your glass is half full?
The glass is half full.
Brilliant. Well, Paul, that's all we have time for now. Thanks an awful lot for coming in. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Money Talk podcast. Check fidelity.co.uk for daily written updates and articles on these and other topics from across Fidelity in the UK. And subscribe via iTunes to get the podcast downloaded direct to your devices every week. Please be aware that the value of investments and the income you get from them can go down as well as up, so you may not get back what you invest. This information doesn't constitute investment advice and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision, nor should it be treated as a recommendation for any investment. Eligibility to invest in an ISA or a pension and the value of tax savings depends on personal circumstances, and all tax rules may change. You will not normally be able to access money held in a pension until the age of 55. Reference to specific securities or funds should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell these securities or funds and is included for the purpose of illustration only. Fidelity Personal Investing does not give personal recommendations. If you're unsure about the suitability of an investment, you should speak to an authorised financial advisor.